Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've got the economics of the Ukrainian elections on the program for you today, the decline and fall of Hewlett-Packard as well, and of course, biometric underwear. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 23rd of May. Good as always to have you with us. And we will, as we often do of a Friday afternoon, begin with 4.5 minutes of live radio in which we digest the business and economic news of the 5 days gone by. For that, we've got John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Also, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so John, I want to detour quickly into the housing market before we get to some of the other stuff I want to talk about. Housing starts up today. Everybody goes, yay. My question, though, is why isn't the housing market stronger? Why isn't it giving us more of an economic boost?
I think the primary reason that we haven't seen any real rush into the housing market is because we had so much refinancing last year that we sort of smuggled forward a lot of housing energy with low interest rates last year. There's just not a lot of juice. No, everybody who wanted to refinance has, and there's wages still pretty low and unemployment still high. There's not a lot of new household formation going on, so we're not going to get it unless that picture changes.
And with rates, Lynette, as low as they are, the Fed's not going to be able to do anything, right? We're just going to have to gut this one out.
Yes, absolutely, and the people that could possibly refinance are thinking, hey, maybe the Fed is going to raise rates soon. So why don't I just forget about this for now?
All right. Fair enough. We will forget about that and move to other news of the week. Earlier this week, John, Credit Suisse pleads guilty, first time a company has pleaded guilty to criminal charges, of tax evasion. Question for you is, are we going to see now more of this? Has the dam burst and the Justice Department and authorities are going to lean on companies to actually get the guilty pleas?
Yes, is the short answer. What happened, remember, when they criminally charged Arthur Andersen and the firm collapsed.
Oh, yeah. This was back in Enron, right? I mean, this was a while ago. Yeah.
Right. And that scared everybody to death. The prosecutors were loath to actually charge criminally big corporations. Mm-hmm. What we've seen now with criminal charges against the hedge fund SAC Capital, now against Credit Suisse, is that it's, in fact, survivable. That it doesn't just mean you go out of business when you're criminally charged. You can even plead guilty, which is what Credit Suisse did. And they're still going on doing the banking that they've always done. So I think this prosecutors will now no longer fear that it's a death sentence for a corporation.
Right. And Lynette, that's kind of the point, right? That Credit Suisse has not imploded and the world goes on, even though this company is now guilty, right?
Right. And so we already know that the U.S. government is going to go after BNP Paribas.
Yep.
I mean, I think the New York Times had the most crushing article when they leaked quotes from Credit Suisse's lawyer saying, please don't do this. This is the exact opposite of what Wall Street banks sort of had us believe for the last 10 years. So here the floodgates are now open. Let's see what happens.
All right. Fair enough. Mergers and acquisitions news. AT&T DirecTV broke on Sunday, John. We reported it on Monday. Besides the whole good for consumers, bad for consumers thing, it just seems to me there's been a lot of corporate get-togethers lately. Are we seeing more mergers and acquisitions now?
Yeah. You know, we've had a big lull for years. Yeah. We had nowhere near the historical levels. I think that is starting to pick up again. There's probably a lot of sort of pent-up demand deals that haven't happened. So we're going to see a lot more of that. That'll be, you know, if you own shares in the companies, that'll help out your portfolio.
Well, yeah, but Lynette, for non-shareholders, when you see mergers and acquisitions pick up, is that a good thing?
Well, it depends on what that means for the companies involved. When you're talking about AT&T and DirecTV, they're going to have to make a lot of promises to consumers to ensure and assuage the fears of politicians that everything's going to be okay. And I'm talking about no bundling, helping people in rural areas get more faster internet connections. The companies are going to have to sweeten the pot so that the government believes that this isn't going to be monopolizing or hurting consumers in any way, shape, or form.
All right. Lynette, last word to you on the markets. Do you care that everything's going just a million miles an hour on Wall Street? Do you care about that?
Everyone knew that this year was going to be absolutely insane.
Really? You know, I didn't know. I missed the memo.
Come on, you know?
I missed the memo.
You missed the memo. I mean, after last year's S&P 500 goes up 30%, this year we've seen choppiness, and it was expected. As David Tepper said last week at a big Wall Street conference, it's nervous time. He said, I wouldn't go short, but don't be too freaking long. It's time to keep some cash. So everybody just hold on to your hats until everything stabilizes.
And that's the guy who made $3.5 billion last year. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too.
Bye.
On Wall Street today, as it happens, green arrows all the way around. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It is by no means a stretch to say that Hewlett-Packard was present at the creation of Silicon Valley. The origin story is practically legend. Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard started the company out of a garage in Palo Alto in 1939 and innovated like crazy for decades thereafter. But HP hasn't quite been in the innovation business for a good long while now, and as a result, it's had a bumpy time of it. CEO Meg Whitman announced 16,000 layoffs yesterday, bringing the total for this fiscal year to 50,000, 50,000. It's a cycle of cuts that's been going on since 2002. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
Hewlett-Packard's last great innovation came about 30 years ago when it introduced the inkjet printer and the laser printer.
And that started as a small, stumbling little business with low-quality products, and they just kept getting better and better and more competitive.
That's tech writer George Anders. He wrote the book on HP, Perfect Enough, which looked at the company's efforts to reinvent itself in the late 1990s after its work in innovation was over.
So at the boardroom level, HP was always thinking, where's the next printing business?
In other words, too focused on looking for monster hits to tinker around with the little innovations that had made the company great. A series of CEOs came and went. HP bought companies and cut workers. A 2008 layoff made at least one list of all-time biggest mass firings, and this year's cut is twice as big. However, tech analysts say the company has a future. For one thing, it's now the old dinosaur. HP's major revenue comes from serving giant corporate clients, and that comes with advantages.
The case for legacy companies is always that they have existing client relationships, they have client trust.
That's Jim Kelleher, a tech analyst with Argus Research. He says the core business HP is now in, managing data, is growing. Brent Bracelin from Pacific Crest Research says even though that business is threatened by cloud computing, HP has time to make a transition.
That $110 billion worth of infrastructure that they sell annually doesn't move to the cloud overnight.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Hachette, the publishing house, and some of its authors are going toe-to-toe with Amazon. Hachette is in the middle of negotiations with Amazon right now, and they accuse the world's biggest bookseller of going out of its way to cut them out, of discouraging customers from buying Hachette books, delaying shipping on some of those books, and misleading consumers on prices. Bigger is better, possibly, but bigger is meaner, also quite possibly. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Nina Layden is a writer and illustrator. She wrote award-winning children's book Once Upon a Memory. And if you go to her page on Amazon...
I can see that Amazon is trying to tell people to buy other books at lower prices and that my book won't ship.
Amazon and Hachette are negotiating, and Layden says she is the collateral damage.
I'm finding myself caught in the middle.
Amazon is big. It controls more than a third of the U.S. book business. Now, does this mean it's becoming too big? Jerry Gutman is a publishing consultant with Lexicon Group.
They are definitely dominant, but at the same time, they're not a monopoly.
Joe Conrath is another author. He publishes through Amazon, and he says this isn't a case of the big guy stepping on the little guy. It's Amazon taking on a quasi-monopolistic publishing industry.
In the past, publishing has had as much power as Amazon, and they were incredibly irresponsible with that power. Amazon is keeping prices low. They are giving authors much better rates than any publisher in history ever has.
That's not to settle the question of who's the good guy for consumers. Amazon wants lower prices now, but perhaps slightly higher prices would invite companies to compete with Amazon, bringing lower prices later. That's the argument of Jeffrey Manny, who directs the International Center for Law and Economics. Regardless, he says,
it's a fight over margins. Both publishers on the one hand, Amazon on the other, are struggling for profits right now.
But in the short term, from the perspective of the affected authors, it's like the Kenyan phrase, when elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Presidential elections are scheduled for Sunday in Ukraine, but the atmosphere in the eastern part of that country is anything but inviting of democracy. At least two people were killed there today in fighting between pro-Russian separatists and forces loyal to the government in Kiev. And whoever wins on Sunday is going to have their hands full fixing the crippled economy, handling relations with Russia, and sorting out the aforementioned tensions between nationalists and separatists. The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Donetsk, that is in eastern Ukraine. Hello, Mark.
Hi there.
First of all, what's it like outside these days? Is life going on, or is it, as we hear in the press, tense?
I think it depends where you go exactly in eastern Ukraine. Here in Donetsk, in the city itself, it's fairly relaxed. The shops are open, the cafes are open, it's a beautiful weather at the moment. But you do suddenly stumble upon armed groups who occasionally come into the city centre, and they're manning the checkpoints on the outskirts. But then if you go out of Donetsk to towns like Slavyansk or Kramatorsk, they are totally in the hands of these pro-Russia armed groups, militias. And there, of course, life is far from normal. There is a sort of siege-like atmosphere in those kinds of places. Of course, that is where the election on Sunday is not going to be held at all. Here in Donetsk, it's a little bit more questionable whether it can or not take place.
How much does the eastern part of Ukraine matter to the rest of the country?
Well, it's thought to contribute about 15% to Ukraine's GDP. This is the industrial heartland of the country. It's where there's a massive mining, steel, iron industry. I went to a bauxite plant a couple of days ago, which makes molten bauxite for use for making steel, which is then sold, exported to 30 countries, including the US. It is an extremely important area in that respect. And that is one of the reasons why there's such a battle for control over this region, because if Kiev were to lose control of the East entirely, then it loses a massive chunk of its economy. And that's why it does not want this area partly to fall into the hands of these pro-Russia armed groups.
The front runner in the election on Sunday is a candy-making billionaire named Petro Poroshenko. Tell me about him.
Well, this is a wealthy oligarch. He's known as the chocolate oligarch because of his chocolate company, which was very successful here in Ukraine. He is very much the front runner. He's wide ahead in the polls at about sort of 40-45%. But he is seen as somebody who potentially could reach out to the East. In fact, he has just made a statement saying that his first trip, if he is elected on Sunday, would be here to Donetsk. And that would be very much a kind of attempt at reconciliation, at healing these wounds here in the East.
But he is also said to be interested in closer ties with the West. I mean, he's very much, it seems to me, trying to have it both ways.
He is. I think he made a statement today saying that there are a couple of things that are not negotiable. One is Ukraine's European direction, and another one is Crimea, which he said will always stay Ukrainian. His pro-European words will obviously go down well in Kiev and Western Ukraine, but less well here in the East, where there are many people who still feel that Ukraine needs to have closer ties with Russia. So he has a very difficult balancing act, but anybody would in a country of 45 million people, which has such diverse and polarized political leanings.
The BBC's Mark Lowen. We got him in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Mark, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Coming up.
You look today versus what you had there 5 years ago, even a year ago, and now they're all holes in the ground with cranes in them.
The case of the disappearing gas stations. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here's where we are. The Dow Industrials climbed 63 points on this Friday, a 3%, 16,606 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ put on 31 points, 0.75%, finished at 4,185. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 0.4%, closed at 1,900 on the nose. You've never heard anybody say that before, 1,900, by the way, on the S&P. For the week, the Dow gained 0.7%. The NASDAQ added 2.3%. The S&P 500 notched up 0.1% today. A lot of stores that you find in malls reported earnings this week. And the collective thud was like that sound you hear after Wile E. Coyote makes a run off a cliff. You know, that long whistling noise and then boom. Today, Aeropostale's turn. The chain forecast an even bigger loss than expected. Shares kaboomed 24%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.53%. I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The markets and most government agencies will be closed in observance of Memorial Day, but that needn't stop you from celebrating the birth of American actor John Wayne, star of well over 100 Westerns, or rereading Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was published on this day in 1897. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was some HR news out of the White House today about the OMB and the Department of HUD. And that is it, I promise, for acronyms on the program today. Sean Donovan, the current Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, is going to move over to the White House and run the Office of Management and Budget. Coming in his stead at HUD is San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro. Now, you may well be under the impression that Secretary-to-be Castro will be in charge of housing policy in this country, but you would be mistaken, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
If you want to be HUD secretary, there are a few things you should know. Number one, the Department of Housing and Urban Development doesn't have a say in the biggest federal housing initiative, the housing deductions in the federal tax code.
HUD has not traditionally been one of the most powerful cabinet agencies.
That's Robert Van Order, a former HUD economist who now teaches finance and economics at George Washington University. He points out challenge number two for Julian Castro: HUD's budget has been cut. Still, Van Order says housing is important, especially now when it's so key to our economic recovery.
And so the secretary of HUD, who has to represent housing and as a part of the discussions of what legislation ought to be.
Henry Cisneros was HUD secretary during the Clinton administration. He says the top boss at HUD still sets priorities for housing.
A HUD secretary can make a difference, tweaking policy and budget, working with the Congress.
And Cisneros says don't forget the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, is part of HUD. It ensures housing loans for people banks pass over. Erica Pothig worked on policy development at HUD. She left last year to join the Urban Institute. She says during the housing crisis,
FHA was essentially the only source of credit for first-time home buyers in particular, but minority home buyers as well.
Pothig says Castro will have plenty of work to do as the housing recovery sputters along. That is, if he's confirmed by the Senate. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Wearable technology is the new thing, right? You got your Fitbits, those activity tracking bracelets. You got your Google Glass, and you got your biometric underpants. Yes, a hospital in Greece is using them to keep tabs on patients with COPD, the chronic lung disease. Apparently, sensor-loaded skivvies can measure heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing rates as well. Also, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk, they might cut costs, too.
There's a rule of thumb in the world of wearable technology. Fashion matters, unless the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Steve Downs says you're sick.
In the case of somebody who's discharged from the hospital, they may have a very strong motivation for putting on something that may or may not be comfortable.
In the case of the biometric underwear, whatever discomfort there is may be worth it. Patients leave the hospital sooner, are less likely to come back, and have fewer follow-ups, a path to lower costs and better health.
The promise of this technology is it allows you to have the data about how effective the treatment is so you can make the kind of adjustments to get the best outcome.
These tantalizing possibilities drive the rush into wearables. IHS Electronics and Media projects in just 3 years it could be a $60 million industry. But it's a tricky business, says Dr. Jesse Shantz, chief medical officer for Ohm Signal, which just introduced a line of workout shirts to monitor your heart and your breathing.
To be successful in this, you have to become commercially viable. To be commercially viable, you have to pick a narrow consumer segment and give them what they need.
The difficult question for consumers is, what do they need?
I think there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of cacophony until we figure this out.
Dr. Bob Wachter is a health professor at the University of California, San Francisco.
I'm particularly worried about your mom, who's 80 but fine, is in Boca, and here you are sitting in Philadelphia, and the sensor that she's wearing in her underpants, you know, shows that her heart rate just went out by 10 or 15. You know, what do you do?
Wachter expects Madison Avenue to pummel consumers with the idea that collecting real-time data helps you and your loved ones. But right now, it's the truly sick who may benefit the most from wearables. Fashion, be damned. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
For as long as transportation in this country is stuck using fossil fuels, which is to say the foreseeable future, we are all going to be stuck looking for gas, which at some point is going to get problematical because the number of gas stations in this country has been dwindling for years. WNYC's Dan Tucker has more now from the island of Manhattan.
If you've ever taken a long drive on the interstate, you've no doubt noticed a trend by the side of the road. Gas stations just keep getting bigger. AAA spokesman Robert Sinclair says multi-pump operations have swallowed up the mom-and-pop shops and brought down the overall number of stations.
With so much consolidation having gone on, you know, it's now ExxonMobil, it's BP Amoco, it's ConocoPhillips, the smaller retailers really have nowhere to go.
This nationwide trend is largely driven by consolidation, but in New York City, the drop in the number of stations is all about cold, hard cash. That's because gas stations sit on land worth millions of dollars, $25 million in the case of one station sold last year. Developers are willing to pay so much because stations are on corner lots along major thoroughfares, something hard to come by in Manhattan.
So it's kind of like the gas station has a red flag on it saying, call me, I'm the next site.
That's Adelaide Polsinelli, a broker with the real estate investment firm Eastern Consolidated.
Maybe if we zoom in a little bit over here.
I sat down with her to look at a map of Manhattan stations. 10 years ago, there were more than 60. Today, just 39.
If you see where any of these exact locations are, do any of them seem like, oh, wow, if that's not being developed, it really should be?
100%. 24th Street right here that we're looking at here on 24th and 10th Avenue is a natural.
Only 11 stations occupy what you might call prime Manhattan real estate, below 59th Street. Seven of those are close to development projects on the west side, meaning they're probably not long for this world.
You see everything that was once industrial, auto body shops, garages, gas stations, all along the west side highway. You look today versus what you had there 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even a year ago, and now they're all holes in the ground with cranes in them.
All this is bad news for drivers like Dawn Cole, who lives in Harlem and drives to work near Wall Street, where there's no gas in sight.
In the financial district, Wall Street area, you can forget about it. You wouldn't need to cross the Brooklyn Bridge to find a gas station actually at that point.
For the last few months, she hasn't been able to get gas near her home either because the local BP shut down to make way for a residential tower. She'd been filling up there for 19 years.
Right now we're leaving from 111th Street and...
Now she has to battle traffic and drive several miles before pulling out her credit card.
So you're entering your Manhattan zip code?
In a Bronx gas station.
Cole fills up once a week, but for cabbies who fill up once a day, disappearing stations mean disappearing profits. Cabbies can lose $40 to $60 waiting in the lines that form just before a shift change. And they run the risk of late fees if they don't return their cars to the depot on time. Driver Mahmoud Zafar says that hurts passengers and his bottom line.
If I don't have to waste time being in the line, I could work another hour
people could get extra ride, I could have extra money in the pocket, at least as much as I spend to fill up my gas tank.
Station manager Vasilios Hondro says business is great. He operates one of the few stations left below 96th Street. But that may not last forever.
You know, if somebody came and offered me like, you know, $5-10 million for this property, but like, for this business, I'd be like, hey, there's the key, buddy. Have a good day. You know what I mean?
With millions on the line, can you blame him? In New York, I'm Dan Tucker for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which I will grant you in advance, is a little bit random, but it's still kind of interesting, so we're going to go with it. It comes to us from the Bureau of the Census. They did a whole big data dump this week, buried inside of which was this tidbit. The most represented age in the American population, that is, the biggest age group, is 22-year-olds. Followed by 23-year-olds, then 21-year-olds, and then and only then, in fourth place, a baby boomer, a poor, lonely 53-year-old. There are, in point of fact, now more people in their 20s in this country, yes, millennials, than there are any other group. All right, we're done on a Friday. That is it. That is Marketplace. Today, the Dow up 63 points, about a third percent. The NASDAQ put on 31 points, 3/4%. The S&P 500 added 8 points. 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a good Memorial Day weekend, everybody, all right? We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.